You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 193 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Problems of Society, An Esoteric View, From Luciferic Past to Ahrimanic Future. 9 lectures translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 4, given in Zurich on the 9th of March, 1919. The way in which certain people feel prompted to speak about the current situation of humanity is really very significant. In a feeling way, at least, they try to grasp the nature of our social circumstances. To illustrate this, I would like to start our reflections today with some sentences from a talk which Kurt Eisner gave to a group of students at Basel shortly before his death. Some of you may have heard these words already, but they are highly significant for a symptomatic evaluation of certain phenomena today. Picking up on things said previously, his words were as follows, quote, "Am I deaf to these things, or do I in fact see clearly that a longing is deeply rooted in our life and seeks air and light, recognizing that the kind of life we have to live today is clearly only the invention of some evil spirit?" If you imagine a great philosopher who knew nothing of our age and lived around 2,000 years ago, say, dreaming what the world would look like in 2 millennia's time, he would never in his wildest fantasies have conceived of the world in which we are condemned to live. The conditions that exist at present are the real illusion, and what lives as longing in us is the profoundest ultimate reality. Everything else is horrendous. We are confusing dreaming and waking. That is all. Our task must be to shake off this old dream of our current social existence. If we take a look at the war, we have to ask whether human reason could conceive of such a thing. If this war has not been what people call real, perhaps we have dreamt it all and are now awakening again. Close quote. Steiner again. So you see, in order to try to understand our present condition, this man resorted to the idea of dreaming. He poses the question whether the reality that now encompasses us can be seen as anything other than a bad dream, rather than reality. Let us reflect on this strange yet highly characteristic instance, in which a very modern human being, a mind at the forefront of things, and someone who feels himself to herald a new age, is compelled by particular events of our day to describe not the whole of outward sensory reality as maya, as illusory dream, as, say, the ancient Indians regarded it, but to ask whether this social reality of ours might in some way be a dream. From the whole context of Eisner's talk, we can see that he was not playing with phrases, that he really meant something he felt when he asked whether our present reality can be anything other than the machinations of an evil spirit. Alongside this, let us set much of what passes through our souls as we undertake our anthroposophic endeavors, above all the fact that we try to see outward sensory reality not as the whole of reality, but as something whose counterpart is found in the supersensible, through which alone sensory reality is rounded into a whole reality. This view of ours is, of course, only a small spark in the currents of thought of our day, which are largely pervaded by materialistic thinking. Now, a man such as Kurt Eisner, who from his own perspective certainly gives no credence to this little spark of ours, at least in his physical awareness, reaches for a particular metaphor to describe modern realities, that of a dream. Our outer reality, he says, is a dream from which we should awaken. In respect of our current social reality, a man like this is compelled to resort to a sense that our common reality is like Maya, illusion, that merely outward sensory reality is unreal. Let us now try to deepen some of the things we have been pondering in recent weeks in relation to the social question, in particular looking at the fact that over recent centuries, people have increasingly come to deny the reality of the supersensible world, the world of spirit, and in the widest circles, in fact, actively oppose and repudiate such an idea. You may, of course, object that there is still much talk of spiritual things from a certain quarter. The churches may not be imbued with the spirit, but words that are meant to express it do, at least, resound from them. Today and yesterday evening, we have heard the church bells ringing almost continuously, supposedly an expression of the life of spirit in the world. But alongside this, we encounter something else, that whenever efforts are made in our day to hearken to the Christ, to hear what he is saying to our times, then it is precisely the adherents of old religious traditions who most fiercely oppose this, who will not receive the word of spirit. Really, very few people indeed seek a true life of spirit today, not one based on faith in an old tradition, but on direct, immediate manifestations of the spirit. In the face of this, isn't it possible that humanity today might be compelled, not by an evil spirit, but by a good universal spirit, to recognize once more the spiritual nature of existence through its suffering of these outward sensory realities? A modern mind experiences this reality as an illusory dream, and a great philosopher of 2 millennia ago could not have conceived what seems to have become the outward reality in which we live. At any rate, the fact that a modern mind sees things in these terms invites us to form different views of reality than are current today. I am aware that a great number of our anthroposophic friends find some degree of difficulty in these ideas about, quote, true reality, close quote, to which I have attributed importance today. But we cannot encompass life today without having the goodwill to address such difficult ideas. How do people think today in certain fields? Take a crystal in your hand. That is a real object. Likewise, if you pick a rose from a rose bush and hold it in your hand, you will say this is a real object too. But are they both real in the same sense? Scientists in all the universities and institutes, in all laboratories and clinics, see the crystal and the rose that is picked from a rose bush as sharing one and the same reality. But there is surely a huge difference between them, implicit in the fact that the crystal retains its form through long ages, while the rose, having been picked, will lose its form after a relatively short time, will die. It does not have the same degree of reality, in quotes, therefore, as the crystal. And even the whole rose bush, if we pull it up out of the ground, does not have the same degree of reality it has when it is rooted in the earth. This suggests we ought to regard things in the world in a different way from the external mode employed today. We ought not to speak of the reality as such of the rose or the rose bush, but at most of the reality of the whole earth in which it is embedded, and upon which it grows from this reality as hair does on our heads. You see, therefore, that there can be things in outer sensory reality which, when divorced from their source or foundation, cannot be called real in the true sense. In other words, we must penetrate the great illusions of outer reality to find its true realities. Modern scientists make such errors in relation to reality. but making such errors and habituating oneself to them over many centuries, as humanity has done, means that it is very difficult indeed to cultivate social thinking in accord with reality. The major difference between human life and the life of nature is that the latter allows things to die when they are no longer invested with their full reality, like the rose plucked from a rose bush. An outward appearance of reality can also possess an unreality, something that is a lie as such. Something that has no intrinsic reality can, however, be realized in the life of society as if it were reality. It may not die immediately, but it will gradually become pain and torment to humanity. Whereas our wholesome well-being will only arise from something whose full reality has been felt, conceived, and implanted into the human social organism. It is not just a sin against the social order, but a sin against truth itself, when, for instance, our modern outlook still assumes that human labor, I have often said this here, can be a commodity. Yes, we can make it into this, in outward supposed reality, but this supposed outward reality will become pain and suffering in the human social order, giving rise to convulsions and revolutions in society. In brief, today humanity needs to reconfigure its habits of thought, no longer seeing as sole reality what comes to expression in apparent outward forms within narrow limits, and seeing in fact that this can be illusion or untruth. This difference between truth and lies in life ought to inscribe itself very deeply in our modern sensibility. As more and more people become aware of this distinction and awaken within them a feeling that they must seek the truth in life and not lies or distortions, the more healthy the social organism will become. But what is necessary for this to happen? It is not a self-evident thing to discover the true or only seeming reality of an external object. Imagine an alien arriving here from a planet where conditions are different, so that he could never have made the distinction between a rose growing on a rose bush and a crystal. If you then placed both before him, the rose and the crystal, he might think they were both of one common reality, but would be very surprised to find that the rose fades so quickly while the crystal retains its form. On Earth, we can only discern the nature of things because we become acquainted with them over longer spans of time. Yet we cannot trace the truth or otherwise of everything we see in outward reality simply by observing it like this. We can do so with the rose, but there are other things in life which require us to create a foundation before we can discern their reality. As far as human social coexistence is concerned, specifically, how do we create such a foundation? I have characterized some aspects of this in the two preceding lectures here, and today I want to add a little more to this. From my books, you will be familiar with the accounts I give of the world of spirit, of the world we pass through between death and rebirth. In describing this life in the supersensible world of spirit, as you know, we must take into account the relationships that hold sway there between one soul and another. Here, the human being is free of the body and not subject to the physical laws of this earthly world that we experience between birth and death. And we can speak in this respect of the powers or forces playing between souls. You can read in title Theosophy about the powers of sympathy and antipathy unfolding between death and rebirth, inner forces in the interplay between souls in the soul world. One soul will bring antipathy to bear in relation to another but this is assuaged by the opposite power of sympathies. Here harmonies and disharmonies arise between the inmost impulses souls experience. And this interrelationship between the inmost experience of one soul and that of another constitutes the true condition of the supersensible world. What one soul can experience with another here in the physical world is only a reflection, a vestige, if you like, of this supersensible experience. But this reflection is something, in turn, that we must properly judge. We can ask this. In terms of social coexistence, how does what we experience here between birth and death relate to life in the supersensible realm? We have often spoken of the necessary threefolding of society, and now we must turn our attention to the middle realm, as I have often described it, the political state as such. People who have thought about the political state in our times have always attempted to discern what it actually is. But you see, modern people, with their materialistic ideas, have no proper foundation for their reflections. The picture is complicated by the fact that in line with the interests of the different strata of society, the different classes, all sorts of things have been coupled with the modern state, and so one can no longer simply assume that this state is a reality rather than a kind of lie. In our times, a gulf has opened between the view of the German philosopher Hegel and that of Fritz Mautner, the philosopher and dictionary compiler. Hegel sees the state more or less as the realization of God on earth, whereas Mautner says it is a necessary evil. It is an evil, in his view, albeit one we cannot dispense with, which is necessary for human coexistence. So here we have the opposing outlooks of two modern minds. Since a great deal that used to be configured instinctively is now the subject of conscious reflection, all kinds of people have tried to formulate ideas about the nature of the state and what it should be. One finds the most varied nuances and divergences in their ideas. On the one hand are the pious proponents of the state as it is, who do not wish to intervene in its workings, and yet seek to shape it in a way that will, if possible, not ruffle the feathers too much of people who do indeed have cause to complain. And then there are the others who want to radically reshape society, so that it might develop into a form of existence which would satisfy human beings. But what we first have to ask is this: how can we gain a view of what the state actually is? We only gain insight into the reality of the state, its possible reality, if we consider with an open mind the threads that can be spun between one person and the next within the state, and compare this with threads spun between one soul and another in supersensible life. You see, the relationship founded on the deep inmost powers of the human soul, on sympathies and antipathies in supersensible life, contrasts with the very external rights-based relationship between people in the life of the merely political state. Here, one person encounters another in the most external framework of common rights. If you think this through carefully, you will see that the state is the very opposite of supersensible life. And this state is all the more perfect in nature, the more it is the exact opposite of life in the spirit, and the less it aspires, wrongly, to introduce something of supersensible life into its structure. It should only encompass the most external aspect of rights relationships between people, and the way they conduct themselves toward each other. Here all men are equal, that is, equal before the eyes of the outward law. This truth is one that can become an ever deeper conviction in us, that the state's perfection consists precisely in the fact that nothing in it is sought except what belongs to the life between birth and death, and is part of our most external form of interaction. But then we have to ask this. If the state reflects supersensible life only by virtue of being the opposite of the latter, how does this supersensible realm enter the rest of our sensory life? I did describe this to you recently from another perspective. But today I wish to add this, that certain residues remain of the antipathies that develop in the supersensible realm between death and rebirth, residual antipathies which we carry with us into physical existence at birth. These residues are counteracted in physical life by everything that comes to expression in the life of spirit, cultural life, the life of the mind. Here people are brought together in religious communities or in other shared perspectives and outlooks. This is so that they can balance certain antipathies that remain as residue from pre-birth life. Our whole culture and life of the mind needs to be a distinct sphere in society, because it is a reflection of our pre-birth life, because in a sense it places us out into the sensory world with the gift of creating a kind of remedy for these residual antipathies left over from our time in the supersensible world. This is why it is so terrible when people cause ruptures and create adversarial factions in cultural life instead of properly uniting there as they should. The residual antipathies left over in us from our spiritual life before birth lurk in the underdepths of the human soul and prevent the aspirations we ought to have from becoming reality. Real spiritual harmony, true spiritual collaboration. Where this ought to happen, sects and factions develop instead. These partisan groups and sectarian divisions are the sign, the reflection, of remaining antipathies from which all spiritual life emerges, but for which it should here provide a remedy. We must regard spiritual and cultural life as something that has an intimate connection with our pre-birth life, an affinity with it, one can say. We should, therefore, not succumb to the temptation to establish this spiritual life of culture in any other way than as a free, independent life outside the state. The latter ought not to reflect supersensible life, but be a counter-image of it. And we only gain a true idea of what really belongs to the state and what really belongs to the spiritual life of culture if we complement our sensory life with supersensible life. Only together do these two realms give us true reality, whereas merely sensory existence is certainly a dream. Economic life is again quite different in nature. Here one person works for the other. Usually he does this because by doing so he finds advantage or benefit for himself, as the other does. Economic life arises from human needs and involves satisfying them. We elaborate on the physical plane everything that can satisfy or meet natural, mundane human needs, or also subtler and yet largely instinctive needs of soul. Unconsciously, there develops within economic life something that in turn works on beyond death. The labor which people perform for one another in response to the egoistic needs of economic life develops subterranean seeds for certain sympathies that must form in our souls in the life after death. Just as the spiritual life of culture is a kind of remedy to heal the residual antipathies we bring with us into physical existence from our life before birth, so what unfolds in the underdepths of economic life is pervaded by seeds of the sympathies we should develop after death. Here is a different perspective on the need for a threefold social organism as it relates to supersensible life. But we cannot gain this perspective without attempting to understand the world through spiritual science. Someone who gains the right foundations for this knowledge will increasingly and self-evidently lend his voice to demands for a tripartite division of the social organism if it is to become healthy. The three spheres of society each have a quite different relationship to supersensible reality, which, as we have said, only constitutes the whole of reality in interplay with sensory existence. Yet in the last 200 years, humankind has said nothing about these conditions of outward physical existence unfolding in the spiritual life of culture, in the life of the state, and in economic life. Instead, old traditions have simply been perpetuated without understanding. Humankind has become unaccustomed to pursuing the path into the realm of spirit in direct inner activity, seeking there the light which can illumine physical reality. But only then do we fully and properly grasp physical reality. Leading circles have set the tone for this unspiritual way of life, and this has given rise to the deep cleft between social classes, which now underpins all life and is something we really must not overlook. I have often reminded you that before the events of July and August 1914, members of the ruling classes kept praising the latest achievements of what they called our civilization. They pointed to the way in which thoughts could now be conveyed with lightning speed over great distances by means of telegraph and telephone, and how other fabulous achievements of modern technology had advanced the life of society and civilization. And yet this culture, this civilization, rested on foundations that led to the terrible catastrophes we are now so familiar with. Before July and August 1914, European statesmen, especially in Central Europe, and there is documentary evidence for this, continually reiterated that peace in Europe was now assured in the long term. The statesmen of Central Europe especially used such phrases when speaking to their parties and supporters. I could show you speeches as late as May 1914, in which such people said that through the well-ordered diplomatic relations between European countries, it was now possible to believe in long-term peace. This was in May 1914. Anyone who saw the real nature of circumstances at the time inevitably spoke differently. Back then, in lectures in Vienna before the war, I expressed thoughts I have often had occasion to utter in recent years, that we are living in something we can only call a cancer of human society, a carcinoma of the social order. This tumor in society erupted and led to the World War. At the time, because the war had not yet arrived, people naturally thought this idea that we live in a social tumor or carcinoma was simply a phrase, a way of speaking. They had no idea as yet that they were perched perilously on a volcano. Nor do they see this now in relation to another potential eruption, truly another such, seething underneath what has long been called the social question. Since people so gladly sleep rather than recognize reality, they fail to see the powers actively at work in this reality and making it reality. And that is why it is so difficult to get people today to recognize what is so necessary, to organize society in three distinct spheres, if it is to be healthy, to work toward a threefold society. The way of thinking required to recognize this need is different in kind from other ways of thinking. The usual ways of thinking start by trying to work out the best way of ordering society, what ought to be done to achieve this. Please note here the difference between this and the way of thinking that underlies the threefold social organism. The latter does not start by asking what is the best way of organizing society, but instead it addresses reality. In other words, how should human beings themselves be freely placed into society and interact with each other to give rise to something healthy? This mode of thinking does not appeal to principles, theories, or social dogmas, but to the very nature of the human being. It says this: place human beings into the three spheres of society, and then these people themselves will dictate how the social order should develop. This is a mode of thinking which appeals to the real nature of humankind, rather than to abstract theories or dogmas about how society should be. If a person lived alone from the beginning, he could never develop the capacity for speech. Human speech can only arise in social community. And someone who lives alone cannot develop any form of social thinking either, no social sense or instinct. Social interactions between people can only develop in the right kind of communal existence. But a great deal now counteracts this socialization in our time. The materialism, which has developed in the last few centuries, has alienated people from true reality. Human beings have been sundered from it and have grown inwardly lonely. Most lonely of all are those who have become detached from life, torn from its living context, and are now related only to the arid machine, the factory on the one hand, and on the other to soulless capitalism. A wasteland now exists in human souls. Yet from this inner wasteland there struggles free something that can emerge from each individual person, inward thoughts and ideas, inner visions of the supersensible world, visions that also explain outer sensory nature to us. And our loneliness, when we are thrown back entirely on ourselves, is actually the best inner state to recognize our individual relationships with the world of nature and spirit, as opposed to the social thinking that should develop. Only by pondering this will we be able to judge the important historical moment we now find ourselves in. In the course of world evolution, human beings had to become lonely enough to seek the life of the spirit in the loneliness of their souls. The loneliest of all have been the great thinkers, living in seemingly very abstract heights, but who in their abstractions were seeking the path to the supersensible world. Yet we must, of course, not only seek the path to the supersensible world and to the natural world, but also in our thinking to the life of society. Since social interaction cannot be developed in loneliness, however, but only in real experience of others, the lonely individual of modern times was not well fitted to develop social thinking. In seeking only to express his inner life, the individual developed anti-social rather than social thinking. We are living, you see, in the most contradictory conditions. Humankind's recent inclinations and longings are an expression of spiritual powers founded on loneliness, but these are powers which the influx of Ahrimanic materialism has directed on false paths. We can fully appreciate the weight and dimensions of this if we ask people what they mean by Bolshevism, which is something that often greatly alarms them. Well, they will reply by speaking of Lenin and Trotsky. In fact, there is another figure I could name, who does not belong to our immediate present, and this is none other than the German philosopher Johann Gottlieb Fichte. No doubt you will have heard a thing or two about the ideal spiritual mode of thinking of Fichte, but it is unlikely that you will have thought of how he expresses himself in human terms, even though you may know of the views he recorded in his title The Closed Commercial State, available for a few pence in the Reclam edition. If you read there how Fichte conceives human assets and commodities, and how he thinks these should be assigned or distributed in the social order, then compare what he says with what Trotsky or Lenin write, you will discover a curious agreement in their views. Then you may well start to see that more is needed than mere outward comparisons and judgments, and you may ask what this is due to. If you study this more closely and try to discover the underlying truth, inquiring into the spiritual orientation found today amongst the most radical figures and theorists, into what, say, unfolds in the soul of Trotsky or Lenin and their particular way of thinking, the forms of their thought, and asking where these could possibly originate, you will discover this. Such thinkers are conceivable, on the one hand, in a different social order, and on the other in this current social order of ours, which has developed in the light, or rather the darkness, of centuries of materialism. Imagine that Lenin and Trotsky emerged in a different social order. What might they have become, do you think, by developing their mental, spiritual powers in a quite different way, in different circumstances? They would have become profound mystics. What lives in such souls could, for instance, become the profoundest mysticism in a religious context and atmosphere? But in the atmosphere of modern materialism, it becomes what it has. If you read Johann Gottlieb Fichte's title, The Closed Commercial State, you find there the social ideal of someone who truly sought to pursue the loftiest paths of knowledge, developing a form of thinking that always inclined toward the supersensible world. He sought to elaborate a social ideal, and this did indeed draw on the purity of the human heart. And yet what fits us to attain the highest ideals of knowledge upon inward paths renders us unfit for developing a social way of thinking, if applied to the life of society. In a spiritual nature such as Fichte developed, a person can only pursue his solitary path. Social thinking must be developed in human community, and the thinker's primary task there is to indicate what shape the social organism might take, so that people can work together in the right way, embedding social outlooks in society itself. This is why I do not try to tell you or anyone today how private ownership of the means of production should be regulated, say, or the common ownership of the means of production. Instead, I say this: try to ensure that the social organism is divided into its three spheres, and then whatever is effected or initiated by the flow of capital will be administered from the cultural spiritual sphere, where all legal parameters will be determined by the political state. Then there will be a proper confluence between the life of the legislative state, the cultural spiritual sphere, and economic life. And then, increasingly, a true social sense will develop, which, starting from certain legal concepts, will conduct into the spiritual cultural organism all we earn that is excess to our own requirements. This will return to the spiritual or cultural organism. Today, such a facility exists only in the sphere of cultural property rights, where no one remarks upon it. One cannot retain cultural property for one's descendants for more than a limited period before it becomes common property, usually 30 years. But this can be a model for giving back to the social organism what has been achieved through individual human capacities, as well as what is subsumed in the capitalist order. The only question, then, is what sphere this should return to. It should return to the sphere that can properly administer individual spiritual human powers in the right way, or, in fact, any individual powers and capacities. The spiritual cultural sphere. People will do this when they stand within the social organism in the right way. And in turn, this depends on this way of thinking. One cannot make any absolute stipulations about these things. But in our time, people have become accustomed to viewing everything from a materialistic perspective, and therefore they fail to see anything in the right light anymore. I have often spoken of how labor has become a commodity in modern times. Ordinary employment contracts do not help here, for they assume labor to be a commodity, and are concluded in relation to work that the worker is obliged to accomplish for the employer. Healthy conditions can only arise if the contract does not govern work at all, but if labor is determined as a legal relationship in the rights sphere, that of the political state. The contract is then concluded in relation to distribution of the product created between the person who does the physical work and the one who does the mental or spiritual work. Thus, the contract can only govern goods produced and not the relationship between the laborer and the employer. This alone will put things on a sound basis. But people ask this: what causes the harm in society attaching to capitalism? They reply that this is due to capitalism's economic structures. But in fact, this economic order cannot cause harm as such. The harm comes, firstly, from the fact that there is no real labor law to safeguard work in an appropriate way. And secondly, because we do not notice we are living a lie, insofar as the worker is denied his full share. But what is this based on? Not on the economic order, but on the fact that the social order itself means that the individual capacities of the employer or entrepreneur are not properly shared with the worker. Goods and commodities must be shared, since they are produced cooperatively, by both the spiritual, mental, and physical worker. But what does it mean if through our individual capacities we deny or withdraw something from someone which we ought not to? It means that we deceive him, that we exploit him. We have to look at these things squarely and openly. And then we discover that capitalism itself is not at fault, but the misuse of spiritual or mental capacities. This relates to our connection with the world of spirit. If you first render the spiritual sphere healthy, so that spiritual mental capacities no longer take undue advantage of those who perform the work, then you make the whole social organism healthy. We have to be able to discern things properly. But to do so, we need some orientation. Today we live in a time when the right orientation can only come from the life of spirit, and therefore our openness to this life of spirit must be a serious practice. Here, repeatedly, we must point out that it is not enough to keep telling people to believe in the spirit. Many, in quotes, prophets are starting to speak of the need for faith in the spirit. Yet it simply is not enough to tell people today, in our current unhealthy conditions, that turning from materialism to the spirit will bring healing. No mere faith in the spirit will not heal us. Celebrated prophets can trumpet this as much as they like, that modern life has made people superficial, and they must now become more inward. These prophets can proclaim that hitherto Christ was only there in people's private lives, but now he should enter the life of the state. This achieves absolutely nothing. Today it is not a matter of just believing in the Spirit, but of filling oneself with Spirit to such a degree that we lead this Spirit right into outward material reality. Rather than just preaching faith in the Spirit, we must speak of a Spirit that really masters material reality, that really tells us how to structure the social organism. Today's unspirituality is not due to people's failure to believe in the Spirit, but to their inability to connect with it in a way that enables it to get to grips with material reality. Lack of belief in the Spirit is not due merely to denying this belief, but also because people assume matter to be merely that, devoid of Spirit. Many people today actually think it very refined of themselves to view outward material life as having no spiritual attributes, as something we should withdraw from and turn instead to a rarefied life of Spirit. Here we have material reality on the one hand, economic reality, say, where we take care of our pensions or insurance. And on the other hand, we enter our meditation chamber and take flight into the spiritual world. Two quite separate currents of life, very nicely sundered. No, that is not the way to live. Instead, the Spirit needs to become strong enough in our sensibilities for Spirit to be more than a sense of personal grace and redemption, and to actually intervene in what we seek to do in outer material reality. We have to introduce the Spirit, allow it to flow into this outer material reality. To speak of the Spirit as a kind of habit is a very easy thing to do. And in this respect, many people can find themselves in the strange inner contradiction Anzengruber's dramatic figure of someone who denies God but affirms this by saying, quote, God knows I am an atheist, close quote. This self-contradictory human figure does actually exist today, albeit in a less crass form than Anzengruber's portrays it. This is by no means rare. People often, as it were, swear by God that they have no belief in God. All this can stand as an admonishment, not to look to a mere faith in the Spirit, but to try, above all, to find the Spirit in a way that enables it to strengthen us, so that we can really understand material reality. Then people will cease uttering vacuous words about the Spirit. Instead, in the very way they look at the world, they will show that they have spiritual insight. That is what we need today, to look at things with spiritual insight, rather than just speaking of the Spirit. This is important, also to avoid people confusing anthroposophic spiritual science with all the chatter about Spirit of which so many are enamored today. I keep hearing it said of certain worldly preachers of a better kind, that their words are, quote, fully in accord with anthroposophy, close quote. Actually, they are usually saying the opposite. We have to sharpen our vision here, gain clearer insights. In acknowledging this, we will come close to the insight expressed in a sentence by Kurt Eisner, which seems to contain a prescience of his tragic death. This sentence, which I read to you, is especially valuable because it seems to avow that while the person who spoke it does not seriously believe in supersensible reality, or at least will have no recourse to it in his lifetime, there is something worthwhile in the view of those who subscribe to supersensible reality. That sensory existence is a kind of dream, is only half of reality. Eisner seems to say that if we examine the shape this sensory reality has assumed in modern society, It does indeed appear very like a dream, and indeed like the invention of some evil spirit. A remarkable avowal. But might we not see things differently? Might it not be true to say that our current tragic, terrible reality originates in the educational intent of a good spirit who prompts us to awaken from an apparent nightmare and seek the full scope of reality, which consists of both sensory and supersensible existence together? We do not have to see our present in nothing but pessimistic terms. We can also draw strength from it to affirm this reality. But it will never be enough to see sensory reality as the whole picture. Instead, we must find our way from the sensory into the supersensible. Those who do not wish to seek this path would be very short-sighted if they refuse to consider this reality as the invention of an evil spirit. If we develop the will to raise ourselves from this mundane reality into a spiritual reality, however, we will also be able to see that a good spirit is at work. And despite everything that meets our gaze today, we can be sure that human beings will find a way through the tragic destiny of the present. But of course, this must include hearkening to the clear need to heal society. This is what I wish to add today to what I said previously. The end of Lecture 4.